Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Maxwell's House is brought to you by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This is Maxwell's House with Ray Maxwell and Dr. Kiki Sanford, episode number 68, Attitude About Altitude.
This episode of Maxwell's House is brought to you by Audible.com. For your free audiobook download, go to audiblepodcast.com/house. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Maxwell's House, the house that is filled with many wonderful things. And one of the things that we're going to be talking about today is aviation, and it seems as though we keep taking a turn in that direction. But welcome to episode 68. It's Attitude About Altitude today. Hi, Ray.
Hi there. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I am doing great. Yes, we are going to focus Maxwell's House a little more. And I have been asked by the TWiT Cottage programmers to focus my efforts in the area of reporting on aviation. There's many new things I understand coming down the pike from the TWiT Cottage. And one of them is going to be that I would focus on the area of aviation, reporting the news in aviation, as well as explaining things in aviation and telling a few stories from my aviation background. So that's what we're going to be trying out and see how it goes.
So what's on the docket for the show today? What are we going to be talking about?
We're going to talk about a number of things. I am going to talk about the volcanic ash cloud that's over Europe that has grounded a whole bunch of flights. We're going to talk a little bit about X-plane simulators. And then we're going to, of course, talk about the accident over in Russia with the Polish president on board in the Tu-154, the Tupolev aircraft that crashed while flying into Russia with many of the Polish dignitaries on board. So we're going to go over the facts of that one and a few other aviation potpourri. But the whole show is going to be overwhelmingly aviation with one exception. I'll get out of the way right away. One of Ray's rants.
I love it. What do you have to rant about this week?
Well, I think, number one, I think the iPad is going to be a really popular in the aviation community because it's large enough to display maps. And you can get aeronautical maps on the iPad. There's companies that will give you updated things. And I think it's going to be a very interesting and appropriate device for the cockpit. So I'm excited about the iPad, and I couldn't wait to get one, but I want to wait until I can get the one, the G3 one, that has the GPS. I'm really not interested in the G3 connection, but I am interested in the GPS as a pilot. And I went to the Apple Canada site this week, and they had replaced one word at the top of the site. Last week it said, coming in late April. This time it said the iPad is coming in late May.
Boo-hoo. Another month.
Yeah, evidently the sales in the U.S. have overwhelmed them, and I think they're diverting their stock, to fill that need first before we poor wayfaring strangers up here north in the north will get one.
So, could you order one? I mean, could you get somebody here in the States to order you one and then mail it to you, and would it work?
Somebody in the States? You mean a place with lots of techie stuff down at the TWiT Cottage? They could substitute that for a check or two.
If it would make you
but
happy.
Just keep in mind, I want the GPS version. No, I don't know when they're going to release that. But, good idea. I like that idea.
We got to be thinking around here.
Oh, well, along those lines, in connection with aviation, I want to warn people. I have touched on this, but I want to be specific this time. There are a whole lot of aviation applications that are fun little applications to play with on both the iPhone, the iPod Touch, and of course now the iPad. And many of them simulate aircraft instruments, and they look like this, okay, where you've got an artificial horizon, got an airspeed indicator, and, you know, and it shows you your heading, altitude, airspeed, you know, everything. However, I want to point out, and I think I have written some of the authors and said, you should put a warning on your site that this kind of device is not to be used as an emergency backup instrument in your aircraft.
Wait, what? Are people actually using them as backups?
Well, I haven't heard of anybody actually using them, but I have heard people, I have had people, pilots, friends of mine, come up to me and ask me, said, hey, you know, I can keep this as a kind of backup instrument in my plane. I said, no.
It's your iPhone, right? It's your iPhone. It's not connected to anything in the plane.
But let me explain, because it gives you the illusion when you play with it that it's a real, you know, it's a real serious device. And it is. It does some wonderful things. But let's just go through them. Number one, attitude. The artificial horizon works on the accelerometers in the iPhone, not on the, it does not have any gyros. So if you're in a coordinated turn in an airplane, it will sum the gravity field from gravity and from the centrifugal force of the thing. And when you're in the coordinated turn, it will show you as level when, in fact, you're banked, you know, like 45 degrees or something. So, number one, it does not give you your attitude when you're in an airplane. It gives you attitude when you're standing on the ground in a 1G field. It does not read the correct altitude. It reads your GPS altitude, which is not your barometric altitude. And airplanes fly, they are assigned, for instance, when you're going to the east, that is when your magnetic track is from 0 to 179 degrees, VFR aircraft, small aircraft, fly at odd altitudes plus 500 feet. When you're going from 180 to 359 degrees magnetic track, then you fly at even altitudes plus 500 feet. If you're IFR, you fly at the even and odd altitudes on those same headings. So that's to give vertical separation. Now, you use a barometric altimeter, and when you're at low altitudes, you set it to the nearest reporting station that gives you what's called the altimeter setting in inches of mercury. And so all aircraft in the area have their altimeter set to that same setting. But when you fly from a high pressure to a low pressure area or vice versa, your altitude indication changes and you're not reading the extra altitude. So the altitude that these iPhones read is a GPS altitude. And, you know, that's not right. The next thing is airspeed. Yeah. This thing, you know, shows airspeed, and it's actually taking the ground speed from the GPS. So once again, it's not a correct indication of airspeed. And then finally, a lot of them say heading, and they can take the heading from, quote, the built-in. Some of the iPhones have a real compass built in, and that heading is real, although you can choose true north or magnetic north. All planes fly on magnetic headings. And then last but not least, some of the applications take their, quote, heading information from, and in fact, it's not heading at all, it's GPS track. So, warning, almost everything it's telling you does not correspond to what you'd see on instruments in an aircraft. Enough on that.
Wow. I just find it absolutely amazing that people would consider using it as a replacement and not look at, you know, it's an approximation. It's not actually accurate.
The thing is, it on the ground playing with it, and if you take it out in your car and you check it against your speedometer and things like that, you go, gee, you know, this thing is very accurate, and it's really fun to play with, and it looks It looks very real and so forth, but you have to understand what it's actually measuring and what an aircraft instrument is measuring, and it's not the same thing.
Yes, yeah, someone in the classroom, someone in the chat room is asking the difference between barometric altitude and GPS altitude, if you can explain that.
Okay, well, the altimeter, once again, the air traffic control will assign you an altitude, or you will report that you're at an altitude, and that altitude is barometric altitude. In other words, the altimeter in an airplane measures the air pressure, and it assumes what's called a certain lapse rate in pressure. Basically, you lose 1 inch of mercury for every 1,000 feet that you climb. In other words, the pressure goes down as you climb away from the Earth. And the altimeter in an aircraft is measuring the pressure. All it is a very sensitive barometer. Mm-hmm. But in order for it to be calibrated properly and read the approximate altitude, and you have to do corrections for temperature and all kinds of things if you want to know your absolute altitude, but it is reading this pressure difference. And like I say, all the aircraft in a given area have their altimeter settings set at the same level. So it's reading, it's measuring altitude based on air pressure. And that can differ from the GPS altitude, which is doing it by triangulation from the satellites.
Right.
And by the way, that altitude is usually not more accurate than plus or minus. Well, there's a 300-foot air is typical for GPS altitude. So,
wow, that's quite a bit of error. It's definitely not as exact and accurate as the barometric pressure would let you know now, where you are. What's the name of the app again? Did you name it?
This app is. Hang on a second. It is called VCockpit. Virtual cockpit, I assume, is what they're getting at. And it's great fun. I mean, I snapped it up right away and as soon as I saw it and so forth. But I have shown it to a lot of pilots, and they say, oh, can I use that in an emergency? And
No, please don't. No. It will become even more of an emergency very quickly.
That's right.
How to make it worse fast.
One pilot was making a joke about this. He says, imagine that you could use that as an emergency backup. He said, you have this up on your plane's dash and you're flying an approach and you're using these instruments and suddenly a phone call comes in on your iPhone. Now, you know what happens when a phone call comes in. It turns off whatever application you're in and lets you answer the phone call. He said, now we know what the airplane mode switch is for. That's to keep the phone calls from interrupting you during your approach on these instruments, you know.
Exactly.
Right.
Oh my goodness. So moving on from this interesting app world, I think there are iPhone apps for everything. The news recently, very recently, volcanic eruption put lots of ash into the air, and that's dangerous, right?
Yes, it's dangerous for several reasons, but I'm trying to remember how long ago it was, but there was a 747 in Southeast Asia somewhere, and mm-hmm. I think it was an Air India flight, I'm going by memory here.
Yeah.
And it was a 747, and it was flying through an ash cloud, and all four engines flamed out.
Whoa.
Now, when all four engines flame out, that gets the pilot's attention.
Yeah.
So they're gliding down.
In a 747?
In a 747.
It's a big glider.
Yeah. They were in a glide. A 747 actually glides quite well. But they finally got down to they kept trying. They pulled out the restart checklist, started going through it. They got down to an altitude where they were out of the ash cloud, and they managed to start, I can't remember what they got. I think they might have even gotten all four eventually restarted. But they first got one started and then another. And, you know, then they were able to maintain altitude, and they declared emergency and went in. But what happens is the volcanic ash, there's two things it does to engines that are very, very bad. One is it It has abrasive material in it, and it's like, you know, running a grinder over every part in the engine, which is not good for it.
No.
And the other is
especially
it has,
in turbine engines, you have really finely tooled machinery. Like, it's everything's within, it's very exacting and within millimeter measurements,
right.
Isn't it?
Nanometer
sometimes, yeah. Yeah. Wow.
No, you're right. There's very, very high, very high precision, yeah. Low tolerances allowed in those engine parts. And if you throw, it's like throwing sand into the engine. You know, it doesn't do it any good. But it also is silica component,
which is can very be rough.
Right? Can be well, but not only that, it can be melted. And it's a fine powder, and it can melt in the engine and adhere to sensors and things in the engine, and that's what causes it to flame out.
Wow.
Yeah, it can mess up the fuel injection and cause the thing to quit. And they think that's what happened in this case. And so after that experience, they do not take volcanic ash clouds lightly.
Yeah, so now they're a big issue for planes.
Right.
Yeah.
And they had some other issues with, but today in Europe, they announced that they would not let any aircraft, they closed the airspace where this cloud was. By the way, it was coming from Iceland. It's a volcano in Iceland that put up this cloud, and the cloud, you know, winds from the west drifted across Europe. And I think it's between 18 and 30,000 feet. And so they said, we're going to close this airspace. And so this canceled an awful lot of flights in Europe today. And, yeah. You know, people were unhappy about that. But
I always think that is, okay, short-term annoyance maybe that you can't leave when you want to and your travel plans have been delayed, but would you rather take off and then crash and die?
Yeah.
I'm gonna stay, it's fine, just yeah. Take a deep breath and just allow it to be a relaxing time for you. Okay, can't fly, that's fine.
That's right.
I don't understand the we have to get there now mentality that makes people upset at the fact that these airlines are actually keeping safety in mind.
Yes. And I'm going to address that in more depth later in the program, talking okay. about another accident. But the moral to the story is never pressure your pilot if you're in an airplane or charter airplane or what. I've seen it. I've stood on float plane docks and heard people say, well, if you won't take me, you know, because of this weather, I know Joe down the ramp, he'll take me, you know, and get all upset with somebody who's trying to save their life.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, really. So basically, the flights have been canceled. Do you have any idea how long the volcanic ash is expected to stay airborne? I mean, how long does a cloud like this, how long is it dense enough to actually cause these airline turbine issues?
Well, there's another issue that precedes that. How long is the volcano going to continue to erupt?
Right. Okay, good question. Fair enough.
And so I don't know. This may take a while to clear. The other thing is they may be able to fly at different altitudes, but once again, airlines don't like to do that because airplanes do not fly. For instance, if the cloud started at 18,000 to 30,000, someone would come along and say, well, why don't they fly at 15,000? Because it's very inefficient and burns a lot more fuel. So, you know, it's not that easy, is all I'm saying, to change. Plus, it creates all kinds of air traffic control thing because you've suddenly got much less vertical separation to deal with for air traffic control. You know, if you squeeze all the airplanes down into a lower airspace, that causes all kinds of problems. And it causes you to mix different kinds of traffic, which is not good either because the aircraft that fly at lower altitudes, you know, are usually slower. And you're mixing slow and high-speed aircraft. So it's not a good thing.
No, not at all.
Now, the next follow-up I have is a week or two ago, I reported that a Swedish pilot was caught flying for 11 years for various airlines in Europe and the Middle East.
Right. He lied about where he... I remember this story. Yeah.
Yes. Well, it's interesting what they have done. I think he got off quite lightly. And again, I say, the guy had to fly lots of checks and stuff during his career and probably was not a bad pilot. I mean, he had to be a reasonably good pilot. But he, you know, he defrauded them by faking some of his paperwork. But he's been fined 2,000 euros, which is about $2,700 U.S., and he's been banned from flying for 1 year.
For a year.
Yeah. So it's interesting. There's many people think he got off too lightly. Others are saying, well, you know, he shouldn't have done it. He should get his hands slapped. But, you know, he couldn't have been that bad a pilot and pass all these flight tests, you know.
Right. I mean, he did make it through this all of the tests. He has been flying without incident for a good amount of time. He has thousands of miles under his belt now. So, it's the initial untruth that should be punished. But yeah, I think it's a really interesting question, because do you take away his entire ability to fly and do this career ever for that one infraction? Is it that serious? I mean, you don't want a lot of people doing that. You don't want people lying about this stuff. Do you make a model out of him and punish him and say you're never flying again? Or
Precisely.
Or like they did, a year.
2,000 euro and a year, no flying. And obviously he's got to go back and jump through some hoops to get his paperwork in order.
Yeah.
But he's now logged. What was it? 10,000 hours or something. You know, so anyway, it'll be interesting to see if there's any further follow up on that.
Yeah, there was an image that Virgil sent that I was trying to throw up here on the screen, the eruption of the Icelandic volcano. And it's a really great picture taken by NASA. And there's a plume of smoke that you can see billowing up from the surface of the Earth.
Right.
From the fissures. And
if that thing continues to erupt, that might be there for some time. So it's going to be interesting to see what happens. I don't know whether it's... I'm going to follow the news and see how long, you know, if the eruption is, you know, erupted and stopped, and now all we're doing is waiting for the cloud to clear.
Yeah.
Or
if it's going to keep on going.
Right. Because that could be a serious problem for European air traffic.
Very serious.
But you don't want to fly through volcanic ash.
No.
That can ruin your whole day.
So let's avoid Iceland for a while, or just stay out of that plume of smoke.
Right. All right. The big story that's been in the news this week, and it's quite a story, quite involved, was the crash of the Polish Tupolev 154 that crashed in Russia, with the president of Poland and many of the top-ranking officials of Poland on board. There were 96 persons on board, all fatalities. The Polish president and his wife was on board, and it crashed in a town, Smolensk, S-M-O-L-E-N-S-K, in Russia.
Smolensk.
And the facts, Smolensk. Now I'm going to quote the facts that I have been able to get off of numerous news stories and report those first, and then I will tell you what would be my best guess and what is starting to come out as they follow up on this.
Okay, before you do that, though, I was just thinking this might be, we've teased it a little bit, this might be a good time for our Audible book pick of the week. This hour of Maxwell's House is brought to you by Audible.com. Audible is the leading provider of audiobooks, with thousands, tens of thousands of titles in all sorts of genres, from science to science fiction to airlines to poetry to whatever might strike your fancy. And in the good favor of Audible, they have offered you, the listener, the chance to get a free audiobook download because you listen to Maxwell's House. And to get that free audiobook download, you have to go to audiblepodcast.com/house. That's audiblepodcast.com/house and sign up for a free trial, and you'll get a you sign up for a free membership and you'll get your free audiobook. And Ray, did you have a pick of the week for us?
Yes, I do. This title will get your attention. The title of the book is Sex and War.
That got my attention.
This is on my reading list. I'm reading this next, right after I finish Don't Sleep, There Are Snakes. But this caught my attention because it's how biology explains warfare and terrorism and offers a path to a safer world. So this is by Malcolm Potts and Thomas Hayden, and it's called Sex and War, and it is available on Audible. And it is an exploration of what is behind war and terrorism and what role sex plays in this. So that certainly got my attention.
Yeah, I actually saw Thomas Hayden speak at a science cafe here in San Francisco earlier or later in 2009. And he was talking about the book, and it's a fascinating, fascinating idea about how sex plays into the aggression of societies. And by sex, we mean male versus female and testosterone levels and young men versus old men versus young men versus young women, older women. How do the dynamics of the populations play into creating an aggressive profile and the likelihood of going to war, and how it has possibly contributed to war throughout history and might contribute to it in the future. It's fascinating.
Yes, I'm really looking forward to the read. I had read reviews of it and said, hey, that's something I want to find out more about, because one of the most puzzling things to me in my life is the wars we get into, because it's, at least to me, it's so obvious that if we could sit down and work out things, you know, with some kind of dialogue and use our rational side instead of, you know, war in the final analysis is a form of brute force communication. We may be in the space age and the aviation age technologically, but socially, you know, the only difference is we've replaced clubs from the caveman with bigger weapons.
That's very true. So if you are interested in this topic, you might consider downloading Sex and War as your Audible book of the week, your free audiobook, by going to audiblepodcast.com/house. And we thank audible.com for sponsoring this hour of Maxwell's House. So, Ray, let's get into the big news of the week.
The big news of the week, and the Tupolev 154 that crashed with the president of Poland and many of the top-ranking officials, both in the military and civilian life of Poland. And what happened is the evidence, this is the facts that I've been able to glean. The aircraft had made three, now this is, there's some dispute about this, but most of the sources I read said that the aircraft had tried to make three approaches into this field and had pulled up and gone around. And on the fourth approach, it struck trees 1,200 meters off the end of the runway. Notice I'm in meters today because I'm talking about an Eastern Bloc flying. And they fly in meters. And it,
meters
it crashed. It crashed 300 meters off of the approach end of the runway. Now, let me go through a few things. The first thing that people ask, because this aircraft is an older design. This aircraft was designed about 40 years ago. The Tu-154 was designed by Tupolev Aviation in Russia. First flight was 1968. It was introduced into commercial aviation in 1972. If you haven't seen one, they look at first glance like a Boeing 727. And by that, I mean they have a T-tail and they have three engines mounted on the rear of the aircraft like a Boeing 727. This particular aircraft had a major overhaul. Its engines were overhauled and replaced in December, so it has very recent maintenance. It had new avionics have been installed. That is, the radios and navigation equipment were supposedly up to scratch. All indications to this point indicate that the aircraft was functioning normally when it struck the ground. In other words, from the crash site, you can tell if the engines were under power at the time they struck the ground. Also, from the radio communications, there was no indication, there were no radio transmissions declaring any kind of emergency or reporting any fault with the aircraft. So now they have recovered the voice recorder and the flight recorder. The voice recorder records the sound, all sound in the cockpit. There's a microphone in the cockpit. And anyone speaking in the vicinity of the cockpit's voice can be heard on this. I haven't heard yet. That they say that they're working with the data from that recorder and that it appears to be intact, and but they haven't reported what they've heard on it. The weather conditions at the time of this approach where they were reporting between 100 and 400 meters visibility, which is very low visibility, and there was heavy fog, and of course they have to get the runway in sight. Now let me point out, somebody's going to say, well, wait a minute, there are aircraft that can land in zero conditions. This is true, but the Tupolev 154 and the airport they were landing at were not equipped with that. Now, today I read a report that actually the only nav aid on this military base, this is a former military base in Russia, was what we would call TACAN, which is like a visual omni range here in North America. Now, this is a nav aid that tells you what direction you are from the airport and how far out you are. And you can do a certain kind of approach to an airport using this kind of instrumentation, but it is not as good as what's called ILS, Instrument Landing System, nor precision category 1 or category 3 landing systems that are available at other airports. So what I'm saying is this field was not equipped to land an aircraft in zero conditions, and my understanding, the aircraft was not equipped for that as well. So what appears to have happened is, by the way, when you do these non-precision approaches, you descend to an altitude, and depending on the terrain surrounding it, you typically descend to an altitude of 500 or 300 feet above the ground. And I'm going to use feet because that's where my practice.
Where you're more comfortable.
Yeah. Well, again, that's what I fly in North America. And then that's called decision height. And at that point, if you can't look out the window and see the runway, you're supposed to apply power, pull up, and go around and shoot what's called a missed approach. Now, when they struck the trees 1,200 feet off of the end of the runway, they were well below those altitudes. They were at like 60 feet above the ground. So it appears that the pilot descended below the decision height, the published decision height for this airport. Now, let me point out another thing. Air traffic control at this airport had diverted another airplane 30 minutes ahead of this flight. It was a Russian military plane, and the air traffic control had the authority, because it was Russian military, to say, do not land here. It is below minimums, and it is unsafe. Now, about 45 minutes before, they had brought a plane in. The conditions weren't quite as bad, and it had landed. But 30 minutes before, they had denied permission to land to a Russian military airplane. Now, civilian aircraft, and particularly international civilian aircraft, they do not have the authority to deny their right to make an approach to minimums. So this aircraft, as I'm told now, this is subject to, I couldn't find multiple sources of this one piece of information. How many approaches did they make? But I'm told that they made three approaches to minimums, pulled up and went around. And on the fourth one, it looks like they flew below the minimums, struck the trees, and crashed. Now, let's look at a couple of other facts here. The two pilots were, like in the U.S., Air Force One, the president's aircraft is flown by military personnel. They're military pilots. And my understanding, again, subject to more confirmation, were that these gentlemen were from the Polish Air Force, and the pilot and the first officer were 36 years old. So they were young military pilots, probably very experienced for their age, but they are in the military, and there were high-ranking military officials on board the aircraft. Now, the air traffic control pointed out three alternate airports that they had sufficient fuel to reach if they chose to do that. But they didn't choose to go to those alternate airports. They kept trying to land there. This begs the question, I don't know, this is pure speculation, but were they under pressure from the officials on the aircraft?
Yeah.
To get in there because they didn't want to go to another airport and be delayed at getting to this ceremony. And, you know, this is a major concern that they may have been under pressure. And like I say, I have stood on floatplane docks and heard prospective passengers, you know, urging, you know, when the pilot says, you know, the conditions are pretty bad, I think we're going to have to not go today. And yeah. I've heard people stand right there and start, you know, getting ticked off and come on, well, you know, last week Joe flew me on this route and the weather was worse than this or, you know. And don't do that, folks. Don't put any pilot under pressure. It isn't worth it. Let them use their very best judgment and pay attention to their judgment and, you know, go play a game on your iPhone or something and relax or go eat somewhere or, you know. And live to fly another day. There's a sign out at our glider club that I think sums it up really, really well. It says, the typical person can learn to fly an airplane with about 45 hours of flying time. It takes a lifetime to learn to know when not to fly. And
And I think that's a very important point. It's the, you know, when to say no and when not to fly. However, if you are being pressured by officials, government officials, how do you say no? When do you say no? When do you just do what they, right. You know, maybe they know something that you don't know and something needs to happen. There is a certain question there about the pilot's authority versus the authority of the state in situations
now,
like these.
Keep in mind that we don't have the voice recorder. It'll be interesting to see if anyone came into the cockpit and said anything.
Yeah, someone in the chat room here, Paul D., says that the recordings should become publicly available, but you know whether that's going to happen or not, we don't know.
Well, they do in the West. We'll see.
Exactly. In Russia or Poland, are they
now,
going to be that
there
open?
Have, I want to acknowledge this. There have been there's a political situation in the world and there's history here and all this sort of thing. And there are many people in Poland that suspect sabotage or something going on. I want to acknowledge that. I'm not going to tell you that I know the final answer to this. But the facts as they're reported, now I'm not standing there on the crash site. I'm not, you know, I don't have access to those recordings and so forth, but the data that is being recorded indicates that a fully functional, properly functioning aircraft was flown into the ground. Those are the facts that are being reported. So we'll have to wait and see if those facts are borne out by the further investigation.
Yeah. Do you know anything about the terrain awareness or what is it? The terrain avoidance and warning system? The TAWS?
I do not know whether this aircraft was equipped with that type of equipment. It could have been. I have a feeling it may have had a radar altimeter. But once again, let me point out that at this airport, this is not a major airport. It's a smaller place. And it doesn't have a precision landing system. It did not have an instrument landing system. It essentially, in North American terms, they were flying a VOR approach, which is a non-precision approach. And to go below 300 to 500 feet on that kind of approach is rather unusual. So, you know, we're going to have to wait for more facts to come out to know positively.
Yeah,
what's going on.
What happened? And that happens so often in crashes like these, where you can't know what was going on. Sometimes you have to wait until recordings come out. You have to wait to see what was happening in the plane itself. And sometimes you want to know the answers, and we can't know them right away.
Because of the extreme political sensitivity in this area, Putin himself is heading up the investigation and calling the investigators in and interviewing them himself. And he's trying to do it according to the reports I have read. And again, this is all subject to further information, but that he's doing his best to do it in an open and transparent way to demonstrate that there was no subterfuge on their part.
Right.
But it's in Russian territory at a Russian airport, you know, et cetera. And, that raises suspicions in some people's minds.
Yeah, the timing wasn't great.
No. The political implications are unfortunate. Mm-hmm. And but what I'm saying is, from the reports coming in now, it looks like a fully functional aircraft flew into the ground. And, you know, we'll have to wait and see. All right. To kind of wrap things up, I'll just touch on one other item in the news.
Okay.
We had a... I mentioned GPS. Now, I did a whole show on GPS, and I mentioned a thing called Wide Area Augmentation System. And this is an additional signal that is sent to a GPS receiver to correct for small vagaries in the signal coming down from the orbiting satellites. And I just, wanted to explain this system because it's really neat. What they do is there are ground stations that they have surveyed in that they know exactly where these ground stations are. And they are constantly listening to the constellation of satellites that are in a medium Earth orbit that we do the navigation triangulation from. So they are listening to these signals and measuring them very carefully. And any slight variations that they see in the signal and so forth, they report the errors, and they send it back up to another geostationary satellite that's over North America. And they send these errors for different regions up to that geostationary satellite, which retransmits them back down to your handheld receiver. And your iPhone uses this and a number of other GPS systems. If it says that they have WAAS, this is Wide Area Augmentation System, and it means that you can get the accuracy of your GPS signal down to about 10 feet, which is incredible. From this augmented signal that do these final little tweaks and corrections to the data you're receiving. And unfortunately, there has been a WAAS satellite failure. The good news is there's a backup, but they like to keep two online at all time, is my understanding. So we're going to keep an eye, and hopefully they will get a second one back online before they have any trouble with the one that is still working. But there's a website. I don't have the...
You don't have the web address?
I don't have it on there, where you can go and see the current status of the WAAS. If you do a Google on WAAS satellite failure, you'll find it'll point you to the website where it gives you the current status of the this wide area augmentation system at all times. Now, this is another question about that incident, and I bring this up because someone's going to say, well, didn't they have GPS on board that aircraft? And I don't know, because GPS would have also been able to augment the accuracy of their approach. Keep in mind that WAAS is only available in North America. So, yes, they might have had a GPS signal, but one that it wasn't as accurate as the ones in North America.
I've got an image here of some of the satellite coverage areas and what would potentially be affected.
Right. And one of those has failed, so we'll see what happens. But right now, there's still WAAS coverage in all of North America. So,
well, that's good, as long as we're covered, right?
Right, right. We can land accurately with GPS in this area. But they always like to have backups, you know, when people's lives depend on their accuracy. And you're trying to do a precision approach with a GPS.
Yeah.
So anyway, that will wrap it up for this week. I'm going to delve into the aviation news and aviation training, aviation devices, aircraft, you name it. And, of course, pull out some interesting stories from my past exploits in the area of aviation.
It wouldn't be Maxwell's house if you didn't give us some stories from your own past.
Right.
So, everyone, I would like to say thank you very much for listening to Maxwell's House. This has been Episode 68, Attitude About Altitude. We've covered some wonderful ground, some sad ground, a lot of interesting ground in the air. And Ray, what is the best way for people to get in touch with you if you want
them to? They can write me with ideas, suggestions for topics and whatnot at ray@twit.tv. So that is ray@twit.tv. And I always like to hear what's on your mind and find out what you're up to and questions you have. And particularly now in the area of aviation.
And that does it for Maxwell's House. We hope that you will join us again next week for more air, up in the air news and stories.